everyone, and welcome to the hashtag SDRAsk podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kokel is here with me today. Hello, Greg.
Sort of. Just got up. I mean, we record in the morning, sometimes 7 in the morning, sometimes 8 in the morning, sometimes 9 in the morning. Today is the 9 morning one, but I'm still working on my coffee, so...
All right, Greg, I'll let you wake up while I remind everyone to please send us your questions on Twitter.
Right.
We're always looking for more questions. We could always use more questions to choose from because we like to choose questions that we think a lot of people will be interested in, that we have a lot to say about. So it's great to have a lot to choose from. So send those on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. If you send a question through the website, just make sure it's only the length of a tweet. Otherwise, we won't be doing it because some people have been sending longer questions through the website, like paragraphs, and that's not going to work for this podcast. So if you do send something through the website, make sure you say it's for hashtag STRAsk and make sure it is the length of a tweet, which is 280 characters, I believe.
Mm. Hey, one qualification on that. I mean, sometimes people just can't get it into those 280 characters because of the nature of it. Amy can always pass. If you can't do it, now this isn't a justification for being loquacious, but if you can't do it, you have to expand it more. Amy can still pass it on to me, and I might be able to just do it as a standalone during the show, and that helps too. Because a lot of times I haven't been, the calls haven't been coming in, and so I work on questions that have been sent in rather than phoned in. So is that all right, Amy? I didn't get her permission before I said that. So the deal is, follow Amy's advice. And if you absolutely cannot do that, then just mention maybe Greg can answer this on the air.
Yeah, we do. We actually do save questions. I mean, we'd always prefer you call in to the other show if you'd like to talk to Greg. That's always a preference. But I do keep a list for Greg if he's ever missing callers. And anyway, if there might be some out there who don't even know about the other podcast. If you don't know about it, just go to Stand to Reason. I think the name of the podcast is just Stand to Reason on iTunes.
Right.
So
right. And that one has been going on for over 30 years. Well, actually, not as a Stand to Reason product, but certainly the whole life of Stand to Reason, we have had our show and made it available. Even before there was an internet, we had a way of getting those broadcasts before podcasts to mm-hmm. people. Remember that Real Audio? I don't know if you're on board at that time. Anyway,
it's a long time.
Never mind.
Ago. Yeah, so that's another. That one actually has live callers, so you're always welcome to call live on Tuesdays from 4 to 6 Pacific time, and you can find the information for that on our website, str.org. Wow, that was a long introduction, Greg. We don't usually do that. I
got
hope
a couple
everyone
more
will
sips of coffee there in the process.
Okay, let's get started with a question from Doug Smith. Okay. Greg says we live in a magical world with immaterial and supernatural activity all around us. Mm-hmm. What examples would you use to demonstrate this to a materialist?
Well, the problem with trying to demonstrate this to a materialist is that it doesn't even make any sense to a materialist. So any claims that you make about the reality of the immaterial realm are not going to be things that are available to him to a great degree, with an exception, and it's a significant exception. So we can say, well, our realm is populated with God and other spiritual beings, and supernatural events are possible. They make sense. Now, one could make appeal to miracles, and there's a wonderful 2-volume set that is a documentation of miracles over the last 2,000 years without parallel. Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R, is the author of that, and it's magnificent. And it's the miracles happen a lot more frequently than people think they do, and they're very, very well documented. And I know some people say, well, "Where's the scientific evidence?" Well, you don't test supernatural events by natural standards. You test them by historical standards, So, in any event, materialists are not likely to pay any attention to that, no matter how strong the evidence is for it. All right. Another way of demonstrating the immaterial realm is real is for God, for example, as we demonstrate that someone like an immaterial God is necessary to explain the things that we see in the material world. And that would be the design of the world, for example. Or that would be the existence of the cosmos. And those are two classic arguments, the design argument and the cosmological argument, okay? But once again, if you're dealing with materialists, in many cases, they are – I'm just going to make this judgment – or maybe it's a mere observation, they are not even handed about these things. They don't – not only do they not accept the agent causation explanation for these things that I just mentioned, they don't even think it's evidence. And so they frequently say there is no evidence for God. Well, wait a minute, about the explosion of the universe into existence. That's not evidence. It happened by itself. The universe created itself, or the universe came into existence with no cause. Really? You think that's the odds-on favorite? I mean, this is crazy. But so they're very, very resistant to that. Now, I think the moral argument is more powerful because moral obligations are not physical. They are one of the things that populate the immaterial realm. And we are all familiar with the objective quality of moral obligations, which is why we complain about the problem of evil. I mean, think about it. Here's the way I put it. Oftentimes, it sounds a little bit whimsical, but it's a very profound statement, I think. Everybody knows things aren't the way they're supposed to be. Doesn't matter where you lived or when you lived, okay? And the atheist does as well, which is why he complains about the problem of evil. But there can't be a way things are not supposed to be, problem of evil, unless there is a way things are supposed to be, all right? Like Lewis said, you can't know what crooked is unless you have straight. But there can't be a way that things are supposed to be unless you have a sposer. Now, that is just a very straightforward, like I said, whimsical and simple way of understanding the moral argument for the existence of God. And the reason why this, I think, is more compelling is that the atheist can't legitimately raise the problem of objective evil without acknowledging the reality of objective moral obligations that evil is a departure from. And obligations are not to immaterial rules. They are to people, persons. So when my obligation regarding driving 35 miles an hour in front of my house, it is an obligation that is actually officially towards the government, but it reflects an obligation I have towards other human beings to act in a way that's safe for them, et cetera, et cetera. So there's got to be a lawmaker for there to be laws, and if you don't have laws, you can't have violations of laws, and therefore you can have the problem of evil. So there's an appeal to an immaterial thing that everyone is aware of because they acknowledge it implicitly with the problem of evil. And then we are making an appeal to another immaterial thing, a moral God as the standard of the universe, as a way of making sense out of the reality of morality that is violated for the problem of evil. Okay, but the third thing that you can appeal to is a little harder if you're not used to this, but it's very simple if you are, and that is appealing to the reality of the materialist's soul. Now, the soul is the invisible self. It's invisible because it's real, but you can't see it. So that means it's part of the immaterial realm. But your invisible self not only displays itself in all kinds of activities that we are can't be explained in other ways, but it is something that every single person is immediately aware of. And even if they deny the invisible self, the soul, it is their act of will that is at the foundation of the denial, and an act of will is not physical. You know, an intention is not physical. You can intend to do something and not act at all. There's no action there. Act of will, then you are acting. Well, see, my arms or my mind, my mouth are working. Yeah, but what caused that to work? Your self initiated that action. It started that chain of events. And, those are just ideas. Really, what's an idea? Is an idea physical? Does it extend in space? Does it respond to the laws of physics and chemistry? If it does, by the way, we don't have any ideas that are our own. We have ideas that are the result of physics and chemistry in our mind, and that's it. We have no control over those things. So, I often will ask people to imagine something, and they imagine, and I have them describe some of the details. And then I ask, where is that thing? That thing that you just saw that has all these details. That's in my brain. No, it's not. If I cracked your brain open, I wouldn't see the details that you, I wouldn't see your mother at the sink washing dishes with a yellow blouse on. You know, I just see gray matter. That thing is so real, you could see it in your mind's eye, so to speak, which is another evidence for the immaterial, your mind's eye. And, you could describe the details, but it ain't in your head. It isn't anywhere physical. It's in the immaterial realm, and we have the faculty to access that with our own invisible selves. And there are dozens and dozens of examples of mental activities that are simply, when you look at the nature of the activity, it is not a physical activity. Now, it may be accompanied with brain activity. There's no question. Maybe C fibers are firing or whatever. Neurons are doing their thing and the blood is flowing. But what we are involved with beholding is not C fibers and blood and gray matter. We are beholding something else. We are beholding the contents of our mind. Now, again, there is no guarantee that these kinds of examples of very real things in the immaterial realm that have powerful evidential support are the kinds of things that any naturalist or materialist is going to find compelling. They don't. In many cases, they explain them away with vacuous explanations, like that's just C fibers. Well, it's obviously not C fibers. That is the thing you're beholding, even if C fibers are connected to the activity or something like that. Now, that isn't to say that these arguments don't have an impact ultimately on the atheist. And I know they do in many cases because former atheists have told me this, that, for example, they were moral objectivists. They realized morality was objectively real, but in an atheistic universe, there was no way to make sense of that. And then in this one case, Holly Ordway, she said, my atheism was corrupting my soul. She saw the damage it was doing to her own soul, even though she had no worldview capable of making sense of either the soul or the damage that was being caused.
So, Greg, here is a follow-up question that goes along with that one from Mike. When discussing, quote, thoughts are not physical, Greg uses an illustration of picturing your mind the color of a person's shirt while they do the dishes. How do I respond to a skeptic who retorts saying that the brain acts similar to a computer by being able to display a photo that is not physically stored inside the computer?
Well, that doesn't speak to the issue at all. Because the question, when I say, well, where's the photo? Where's the image? They said it's right there on that screen. All right. So now we have a locus for that image that the computer can produce. So I don't have any problem with the illustration. But my question isn't whether our brain, the computer, can produce an image. The question is, where is that image? And the image is something we are beholding in detail that is not in the physical realm. That's the point. Okay, the question is whether all of these things are physical. All physical things have physical locations in the three-dimensional universe, and they all extend in space. It's the nature of being physical. They all are subject, even by the naturalist, materialistic naturalist's own rules, to the laws of nature. That would be physics and chemistry. So if a thing is physical, it is going to be located in the physical universe. It is going to be extending in space. It's going to have physical qualities like shape and weight and the like. I should say extended space, not necessarily shape, because like gaseous things and liquid things don't have a determinate set shape, but I think people get my point. And they are subject to the laws of physics and chemistry.
Like a computer screen and an image on a computer screen.
Exactly,
would fall into that.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking at you on the computer screen right now. I said, there's the screen and there's the image. So he says, where is that image? It's right there. Okay. In this case, because the screen is physical, it's third person public. Notice this is something else about physical things. They are at least in principle, public items. Now, if you read the Hobbit, you know, there was an exchange not Frodo, but the other guy, the first guy, in The Hobbit, you know, with Gollum, and you know, what's in my pocket?
Gandalf?
Oh, Gollum, who is that?
Oh, are you talking about Gandalf or are you talking about Gollum?
No, I'm talking about the other guy, the guy who had the ring, who stole the ring. What is this?
Bilbo? Bilbo Baggins.
So Bilbo says, what's in my pocket? Well, he couldn't see what was in his pocket. That was the nature of the riddle, but he could have taken it out. So in principle, it's third person public. But what's the contents of your mind are not like that. They're not third person public. This screen, my wife could walk in, my daughters could walk in and see the screen. Okay, nobody can see the screen on my mind. Nobody but me. It's first person private. And this is another indication that it's not merely physical. All physical things are at least in principle, just like the ring in Bilbo's pocket, are third-person public, because that's the nature of physical things. And so you have one has to get in his mind or her mind the distinction between physical things and non-physical things, and physical things have certain qualities. And if the thing you're beholding does not have those necessary qualities of a physical thing, it ain't a physical thing. It's just that simple. Now, you could be really contentious and say, well, I'm not going to believe that. And then I'm going to ask them, that belief that you're not going to have, instead you have a different belief, where is that belief? Does it extend in space? Does it have chemical quality? No, it has propositional qualities. You know, no chemical has propositional qualities. Only propositions have propositional qualities. Okay, and that's not physical.
So
it's really very straightforward, but it's just amazing at how resistant people are to accept that when they're inclined to accept and to affirm and to stick with a materialistic point of view against all in the teeth of the evidence. Let's put it that way.
So then what would you say to someone who responds? And you touched on this really briefly earlier, but someone who responds by saying, but they can see when you think, they can see certain things firing in your brain, they can see that these are physical processes.
Right. Well, I don't take exception with that. It is the case that there are frequently physical things that are going on at the same time mental things are going on. All right. No, but that's called correlation. That's not identity. Identity, when you say one thing is identical to the other, you're not talking about two things. You're talking about one thing, strictly speaking. I mean, we say, I have identical cups here. Well, that's an imprecise way of using the concept of identity. Identity is like Greg Kokel is identical to the president of Stand to Reason. So there we have two different designations applying to the same individual. And that is everything that is true about the first is true about the second. Now, when it comes to these kinds of activities that we're talking about, it may be that every single time that I am willing to speak, it's an act of will that's causing me to speak, that there are all these activities going on in my mind, okay? But my act of will has certain qualities, and the physical activities have very different qualities. They're not identical. They just are constantly correlated. And by the way, they're not always constantly correlated. Okay? Because there are things that are very, very well documented, near-death experiences in which there are occasions of what's called remote viewing. Now, I'm not taking every claim to near-death experience to be evidence for the existence of the soul, but some of them are. So when a person leaves his body in the operating room and the body is inert and there's no activity that can be registered, and that person goes to a different location, somewhere in this, sometimes in the same building, sometimes miles and miles away, maybe even to the scene of the accident where their body had been transported from through it with an ambulance, and then is able to observe things going on there, and then comes back to the body, and the body then is resuscitated, and he is able to report what he saw at a place where his body was not, then it's clear that the things that he saw were not a function of his bodily activity. And, well, how do you know that fairy tale is true? All you got to do is look at the evidence. And if he knows things that he could never have known unconscious on the surgical table, then it's clear that he gained that information from first-person experience away from his body. So two things here. Correlation is not identity. Just because C fibers are firing when I'm thinking about something doesn't mean my thoughts are the C fibers. And it turns out we have powerful evidence, and not just a little story here or there. This is so well documented. There are thousands of cases, especially after about 20 years of reviewing this kind of stuff, of people having a bona fide, veridical, that is truthful, evidentially substantiated remote viewing experiences. So this rejoinder doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't disagree with the point at all. It just says that there are some things that must go on. Look at when my hand is on the steering wheel, and as my hand is turning the steering wheel of my car, my tires are turning too. So they are coincidental. They are happening at the same time. And a necessary connection. I mean, my hand's on the steering wheel moves, the wire moves. It's all connected physically. Okay. Are the tires moving the steering wheel just because they're correlated directly all the time? No. If my will wasn't being exercised, my hand wouldn't turn the steering wheel, causing the tires to turn. It does no good to say, well, wait a minute, you're nutty, you are turning it. Every single time the steering wheel is moving with your hand, not the tires are moving. So there, it's the tires that are doing the driving, not you and the steering wheel. Well, you see how nonsensical it is. It's clear that I'm doing the driving, and we know this because we're the drivers. We are willing our hands to turn that causes that physical thing to take place. Even though the activities are constantly correlated.
Any immaterialist is going to have to bite a pretty big bullet if they want to say that they are not immaterial initiating certain actions.
Right.
Because if they're only material, that means there's no them to initiate something. Everything
That's right.
is caused by a physical process. So when you look at yourself and the things that you decide to do, every day, the something immaterial is doing something in the material world, mm-hmm. and that's our wills and our initiating actions with our bodies.
Yeah.
So if they want to deny that, they have to deny. I mean, that's like I said, that's a pretty big bullet to bite. To
it's
say
an artillery
that,
show.
Yeah.
And it's still loaded. You know,
so
it's still alive.
Yeah.
It's still a live round. I mean, Sam Harris bites this bullet. He says, because what's left is what you just described as determinism. There is no individual starting thing. It's all dominoes falling. But if it's all dominoes falling, how would you know there are dominoes? It's all dominoes falling. You have to be a self that can reason independent of the deterministic system in order to come to the conclusion that it's all deterministic and reason's not possible. So it's kind of a self-defeating enterprise. I do not see why Sam Harris does not see this. He is a smart guy. He's got a PhD, whatever. He's one of the so-called new atheists. So they're 20 years old now, so they're not that new anymore. But I don't understand why this isn't obvious to everybody that listens to him. Wait a minute, you're a determinist. Well, how would you ever know that determinism is true if all you are is a domino falling? By the way, all you are, your actions, is a domino falling. And so is all of your thoughts and conclusions and decisions, because that's all part of the physical process, according to your... He's a neuroscientist. I think that's his field. And so he's deeply committed to that kind of physicalism that that's being expressed here. But it's so fraught with serious difficulty. It stuns me that it's almost like either willful blindness or just judicial blindness from God, that these people can't see the obvious thing. You know.
All right. Well, hopefully that gives you some ideas, Doug and Mike. Thank you for your questions. And thank you, everyone.
Oh, man, are we done already? You're winding down.
Yeah. We're over, Greg.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. We appreciate you listening, and we thank you for your questions. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.